Today, can you trust your bank in a crisis? Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and property news. Well, banking is a game of confidence in that if fears of a potential bank collapse arises, then naturally people who hold money at that institution will try to grab their cash and run. The global financial crisis, where many banks were saved by the use of public funds, for example, like the Bank of Scotland, now NatWest in the UK, because they were too big to fail and because there was a risk of a run on the bank as depositors tried to draw out their cash. But this means taxpayers are on the hook. And so post the global financial crisis, there were attempts to develop alternative models which would transfer risks from the taxpayers to other parties, including shareholders, bondholders, and even depositors of an affected bank. The so-called bank resolution or living will includes the deposit bail-in regimes, which were proposed initially, by the way, by merchant bankers and adopted by the G20 to allow deposits held at banks to be grabbed and converted to equity. This happened, of course, in Greece a few years later, as this EU paper outlines. In the IMF Global Stability Report from October 2023, there was a section which highlighted that the March 23 bank runs in Switzerland and the US were unusually large and fast, with their speed and size facilitated by rapid online deposit withdrawals and the rapid spread of worries among important groups of depositors via social media and other digital channels. Although the runs were not as severe and as fast as the run on Silicon Valley Bank, banks had experienced rapid online runs before this. The 2007 deposit run on the UK bank Northern Rock took place mostly via the internet. The bank lost almost 60% of its retail deposits in 2007, including 20% over just 5 days between September the 13th and the 17th. And in 2008, the UK internet banking branch of the Icelandic bank Landsbanki also suffered a rapid run amid the broader Icelandic banking crisis. Earlier advances in banks' use of technology triggered similar concerns about speeding up deposit withdrawals in a crisis. For example, the US Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation's official history describes that organization's rescue of Continental Illinois National Bank and Trust in 1984, the episode from which the phrase "too big to fail" originates, as resulting from a high-speed electronic bank run. The capacity for concerns to spread rapidly within a concentrated or closely connected group of depositors has long been recognised as a potential contributor to bank runs. One of the first major bank failures of the Great Depression was the 1931 failure of the Bank of the United States, whose customer base, concentrated among New York City's foreign-born population, also facilitated this rapid spread of the bank run. And some crises that have affected the entire financial sector have matched the scale of the 2023 bank runs, as this chart, again from the same report, shows. The IMF, in a recent blog titled "More Work is Needed to Make Big Banks Resolvable," argues that recent failures represented the most significant tests since the global financial crisis of ending too big to fail, whereby a systemic bank can be resolved while preserving financial stability and protecting taxpayers. They look at what happened to Credit Suisse, a globally systemic bank with $540 billion in assets and the second largest Swiss lender, founded in 1856. When that failed, it was sold to UBS, and the US-based Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank, and First Republic Bank failed at around the same time amid Federal Reserve interest rate hikes to contain inflation. With a combined $440 billion of assets, they were the second, third, and fourth biggest bank resolutions since the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation was created during the Great Depression. Their view is that the actions of authorities last year successfully avoided deeper financial turmoil, and the financial soundness indicators for most institutions signal continued resilience. In addition, unlike many of the failures since the global financial crisis, this time significant losses were shared with the shareholders and even some creditors of the failed banks. However, Taxpayers were once again on the hook, as extensive public support was used to protect more than just the insured depositors of failed banks. Amid a massive creditor run, the Credit Suisse acquisition was backed by a government guarantee and liquidity nearly equal to a quarter of Swiss economic output. And while the public support was ultimately recovered, it entailed very significant contingent fiscal risk and created a larger, more systemic bank. Use of standing resolution powers to transfer ownership of Credit Suisse after bailing in shareholders and creditors rather than relying on emergency legislation to effect a merger would have seen Credit Suisse's shareholders fully wiped out and potentially less public support extended. In the US, in addition to easing collateral requirements for liquidity support, the authorities cited systemic concerns to invoke an exception allowing protection of all deposits in two of the failed banks. This significantly increased the costs for the deposit insurer, which will need to be recouped from the industry over time. Even very large and sophisticated depositors were protected, not just the insured. Credit Suisse's depositors lost confidence after prolonged governance and risk management failures, and in the US, the failed banks pursued risky business strategies with inadequate risk management. So the IMF says supervisors in both cases should have acted faster and have been more assertive and conclusive. Policymakers need to better empower banking supervisors to act early and with authority if needed. Even smaller banks can be systemic. Supervisory and resolution authorities should ensure sufficient recovery and resolution planning for the sector. This should include banks that may not be systemic in all circumstances, but could be in some. Resolution regimes and planning needs sufficient flexibility, they say. Policymakers should ensure resolution rules and plans are flexible enough to balance financial stability risks and taxpayer interests. Government support may still be required in some circumstances, for example, to avoid a systemic financial crisis. And while authorities should continue pursuing Plan A, they need the flexibility to depart from it and, for example, combine different resolution tools as necessitated by the specific circumstances at the time of failure. And they go on to say that liquidity in resolution is crucial. Banks typically fail because creditors lose confidence even before the balance sheet reflects potential losses. Rebuilding capital buffers in resolution may not be sufficient in its own to restore confidence. Authorities must make further progress on how quickly banks heading into resolution could receive liquidity support, including pre-positioning collateral and testing preparedness while still protecting central bank balance sheets. Now, this is, of course, code for the deposit bail-in regimes. The status of the bail-in arrangements is hotly debated, with ASIC and the RBA assuring Australian depositors there is no intention, even in a crisis, to grab deposits. But arrangements are certainly in place in some countries, with the New Zealand Open Bank Resolution perhaps the best example. The Reserve Bank of New Zealand says OBR allows the bank to be kept open for business while placing the costs of its failure firstly on its shareholders and then, if necessary, on its creditors, rather than having some or all of this cost borne by the taxpayer. When OBR is applied, it allows customers to gain full or partial access to their accounts and other bank services while an appropriate long-term solution to the bank's failure is worked out. Under OBR, a proportion of creditors' claims may be frozen to absorb losses, and other shareholders will be the first to lose their investment in the bank when failure occurs. Only when the amount of shareholder funds is insufficient to absorb losses will some portion of creditor funds be frozen. OBR does not change the fact that creditors to a failed entity may lose money if the business owned them cannot meet all its obligations. While OBR is not designed to determine how the bank failure should be resolved in the long term, it creates time for a full analysis of the appropriate course of action to be determined. Now, it's important to understand that if you deposit money in a bank, it's effectively an unsecured loan to that bank. And in the case of a failure, therefore, other than insured amounts, which will be protected by the government, at least in theory, the remainder would be accessible to creditors of the bank. And if they were secure creditors, they could well rank above depositors. In Australia, The Financial Claims Scheme, the FCS, is an Australian government scheme that provides protection to deposit holders with Australian incorporated banks, building societies and credit unions, known as Authorised Deposit Taking Institutions, or ADIs, and also general insurance policyholders and claimants in the unlikely event that one of those financial institutions fail. The FCS is a government-backed safety net for deposits up to $250,000 per account holder per ADI, and it also covers most general insurance policies for claims up to $5,000, with claims above $5,000 eligible if they fulfill certain criteria. Once activated by the Australian government, the FCS is administered by the Australian Prudential Regulatory Authority, or APRA. Actually, the IMF says authorities in many countries need to strengthen deposit insurance regimes. New technology like 24/7 payments, mobile banking, and social media have accelerated deposit runs. Last year's failures followed rapid deposit withdrawals, and deposit insurers and other authorities should be ready to be able to act more quickly than many currently can. The US banks that failed were outliers with balance sheets that have grown very rapidly, funded by a higher degree of uninsured deposits. Where wider coverage is being considered, it would need to be adequately funded, particularly in countries with deposit insurance that is not backed by a sovereign with deep pockets. Policymakers should be careful not to overextend deposit insurance coverage. If not backed by a commensurate rise in deposit insurance funding, depositors could quickly lose confidence. But the bottom line, they say, is that progress has been made, but that there is still further to go in putting an end to too big to fail. Last year's bank failures provided a valuable check on the progress that policymakers are making on the reform agenda and to set course for the remaining ground to be covered. But the fact that governments choose to assist banks rather than activate a bail-in regime is actually, on one hand, positive, not least because if a bail-in was activated, then confidence would be destroyed across the banking system. But on the other hand, again, the IMF is still wanting to drive this into the financial system and to ensure that financial regulators can exercise those powers in a crisis without government approvals. I'm often asked if bail-in is a real risk to savers, and my reply remains the same. It's a theoretical risk for sure, thanks to the likes of the IMF and others, but practically, it's unlikely to be activated because the collateral damage would be enormous. But understand that those bankers who dreamed up bail-in and the quangos who are pushing it are still pushing governments to give the financial regulators ever more power, never mind democracy. So it's a cautionary tale of who is actually calling the shots, and the risks to democracy are real. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.